Before we begin today's episode, I wanted to give a bit of a warning. Today's conversation deals with the topic of sexuality, and we will be talking about sexual assault, sexual abuse, and other things related to sexual unhealth. If this is something that's problematic for you, or you have a hurt in your history that would cause this to be a difficult conversation, please know that you don't have to listen to this episode. Now on to the conversation. Here's a question for you. Who taught you about how your sex life was supposed to go? Who taught you about your responsibilities when it came to sexual habits, interactions? If you're female, who taught you about the interaction between you and a male? If you're a male, who taught you about the way that you should treat women in a sexual context? Our conversation today is about the restlessness around human sexuality, especially when it comes to the church, and especially as it comes to talking about the interaction between two people in a sexual relationship. Our guest today, Sheila Gregoire, has written and researched this topic more than anyone else I've seen in quite some time, and she has some surprising insights about sexuality, the church, and the way that we teach about it. Through these insights and our conversation, I hope that we'll find a gift in the midst of the restlessness around God, sex, and us. Here's the conversation. Sheila, as somebody who's been watching your presence on social media and reading some of the writing that you've been doing, it really is an honor for me to be able to talk to you and that you've taken some time to talk with the audience today. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Beginning with this idea of restlessness, and I'm curious, especially with you, because I think there is some relevance of that to that word to what you're curious about, what you care most about. But just sitting here today in our respective places of recording, I wonder how that word restlessness hits you. What does it mean for you today?
Oh, I think there's two elements of it. I mean, one, the reason that you're restless is because you're not comfortable. You're not happy with the way that things are. And so for me, that leads to two different emotions. One is hope that we're going in the right direction, that things are changing. But the other is anger. And I don't think anger is always a bad thing. I think anger is often what motivates us to change. Without anger, we often don't have enough oomph, enough reason to change things. And I think that's where I'm sitting right now, is I'm in the middle of this very restless period in my faith, because I've opened a huge can of worms that I can't put back in that can. And I'm hoping that something good comes out of this.
Yeah. For people who aren't familiar with what you've written or the work that you've committed yourself to, talking about sexuality and the church, that's a very big umbrella, and I know that there's more to it than just that, but that's been the direction you've been on for a while. What was there an event or a moment that really started that for you? And you work with co-authors as well, one of whom is your daughter, correct?
Yes. So it's very strange. Mother-daughter team talking about sex. It is. You know, I've been writing about sex, since 2010, probably. I had a book published in 2012, Good Girl's Guide to Great Sex, that I have since updated, 31 Days to Great Sex. Like, I was talking about sex online. I was getting quite well known in the Christian world about that. And then I like to say that everything changed in 2019, when I was procrastinating one day, and I was involved in a Twitter debate about whether you needed love or respect, referring to Emerson Eggerich's bestseller, Love and Respect. And I realized I have that book and I've never read it. So I went and grabbed it, turned to the sex chapter, and what I read shocked me. And I feel it was like a nuclear bomb that went off in my living room, because he said that sex was about a man's physical release and that if they don't get physical release, they will come under satanic attack. And that if your husband is typical, he has a need you don't have. And there was not a single word about a woman's pleasure, not a single word about intimacy. And I thought, if this is what is being taught in the evangelical church, we have some major work to do. Because up until then, I'd never read other books. I assumed they love Jesus, I love Jesus, we're all saying the same thing. And then I realized, oh, wow, we're not. And so from that moment, everything changed for us. I have a team working for me. Two young moms were working for me just from home while they looked after their kids. One of them was my daughter. One of them's Joanna Sawatsky, who's an epidemiologist and statistician. And we just decided we would start doing research. So we've since surveyed 32,000 women to find out how teachings in the evangelical world have affected women and girls, specifically about long-term marital and sexual satisfaction.
Yeah. And the term that I have seen you use for this is talking about evidence-based teaching on sexuality, on sex and sexuality. Can you contrast that with what has been happening, what you found in Egrich's book and then numerous others that you've mentioned in the past? What's the difference between an evidence-based teaching on sexuality and the other, whatever that might, I hesitate to say the quote unquote biblical or traditional, mm-hmm. maybe is a better way to say it. What's the difference between those two things?
Yeah. So in our first book, Great Sex Rescue, we really doubled down on this, but we go back to what Jesus said. So Matthew 7, Jesus is talking to his disciples, and the context is, how do you tell when someone is a false teacher? And he says, look, a bad tree can't bear good fruit, and a good tree can't bear bad fruit. And so you'll recognize them by their fruits. And I believe that that is true. That many times we have different interpretations, different ideas of what marriage should look like, different ideas of what sex is about, different ideas of how the genders act. And Jesus says, when there's different ideas, you judge by the fruit. And what's happened largely in evangelicalism is that we haven't done that. We've allowed people to just write books that become our bestsellers that are based on people's opinions, but they're not based in data, and they're not based in anything that has any evidence behind them. And so what we're trying to do is actually measure the effects of the teachings that are so prevalent in evangelicalism, see how they affect, you know, women's sexual satisfaction, orgasm rates, rates of sexual pain, their marital satisfaction, rates of divorce. And then in our newer book, when we look at women's experience as teenagers in church, you know, what's your chance of marrying an abuser? What's your long-term marital and sexual satisfaction? What's your self-esteem? Like, let's look at some of the actual outcomes so that we can see what's good and what's bad. Mm.
And so before, it's a lot of it is folk tales, conventional wisdom, very much slanted. And so before we came on the call, I was telling you, in my background, I saw how much was placed on this wildness that men have, that was the responsibility of women to manage. My lust was supposed to be managed by someone else, specifically the females in my youth group. And your new book, She Deserves Better, has that slant of talking to women, specifically parent mothers of teenage and younger women, but also as a father of a teenage daughter, I found some stuff in there, a lot of things in there that I thought, oh, this is really, really helpful. Some of it I did, some of it I didn't. So there's a little bit of repentance going on in my own world. But to go to talk about data, what I love about what you all have done is that you have engaged data, but also engaged stories. Because there could be a tendency to try and disprove data by saying, but data is not human. It's just numbers, but you've done a great job of integrating. How did you all walk that line between, you know, numerical research and the actual people that are experiencing it?
Well, that's why we have three people on our team. So Joanna is our stats person. Rebecca is our psychometrics person. So she writes the survey, my daughter, and she also does all of our qualitative research. So she does all our focus groups, gets the stories, and then she helps me write. I primarily do the writing. But yeah, we also did a lot of interviews. So it wasn't only data. When we knew there was something we really wanted to dig down on, we asked for people who had had that experience, and then we interviewed them and took down their stories too.
And when you talked about restlessness and you mentioned anger and hope, my guess is those two things arose out of most all of the interviews that you did. As I read them, there were times when I thought, oh, okay, well, this is going in a good direction. And then there was some where I thought, this is just infuriating that we're continuing to allow a culture of this to happen. Is that how you receive them?
Yeah, very infuriating. And you know, even as we've been talking about our findings, I've had so many conversations with people fairly high up in the evangelical world who are still spouting rape myths, you know, but boys can't stop. Girls need to know that boys can't stop. And this was very much taught. Shanti Feldon wrote one of the best-selling books for teen girls in the height of purity culture for young women only. And in that book, she said that 82% of boys feel little ability or little responsibility to stop in a makeout situation. That is straight up rape culture. Mm-hmm. You cannot say that 82% of boys have little ability to stop. You know, so what? So boys can't help but rape you? Mm-hmm. And yet this is what has largely been taught. And I'm just amazed at how many leaders are still insisting that this is true.
I wonder, for you having interrogated that idea, what is it that's continuing to push that idea forward? What's the thing that's sustaining it?
I think it's what you said. I think there's two elements to it. First of all, what you said is really true, that we have largely put the responsibility for men's and boys' sins on someone else. Mm. So in She Deserves Better, we're specifically looking at teen girls. But this is true in a marriage situation as well, as we talked about in Great Sex Rescue, where if a guy has a problem with porn, the wife is told you need to have sex with him a lot. Mm. So in Sheet Music by Kevin Lehman, for instance, he actually tells women, you know, to have sex during or to give sexual favors during your period, because you can't expect him to go for 5 days without watching porn, without sexual release. Mm-hmm. So this is taught in our bestsellers. Every Man's Battle called women methadone for their husband's sex addictions, and that you should be giving sexual favors. In our book to teens, what we find the messages over and over again is that boys have a sexual drive and they can't help it, and it's overwhelming. And so when you're in a makeout situation, it is your responsibility to stop because he can't. And 68% of girls reported being taught this in youth group and believing it. Mm. So then what happens to that girl when she's in a makeout situation and she says no, and he doesn't listen to her no? You know, she actually thinks, well, what did I expect? Because I started. Mm. I let him kiss me. I wanted him to kiss me. And so now, because we were kissing, what did I expect him to do? Because I know that he can't stop.
Yeah. And playing that out into the most disastrous cases, in cases where that leads to rape or sexual assault, mm-hmm. then again, it reflects the fault back onto the victim.
Yeah.
And you mentioned an acronym that I have heard a bunch of times, and I don't know if people know it well enough, but I really wanted to hear you talk about it because it's so critical, not only to this discussion, but also I feel like, and maybe it's because we have more access to media than maybe ever in history, but I feel like church, religion, and faith is having a sexual crisis by way of abuse, and it feels like everything is rising to the surface, whether it's well-known mega pastors or ministry leaders and these people who are seen as kind of the bastions of character are now having these, you know, sexual immorality come out. And I think the acronym is DARVO, and
yes.
How helpful that is, especially for people who are watching stories unfold. So, mm-hmm. and there's a typical pattern. So there's the disclosure that something may have happened, and then there's the investigation. But always in the middle of that, this acronym starts to come up. Can you talk a little bit about the DARVO, D-A-R-V-O acronym?
Yes. So what it refers to is a strategy that is used either by abusers or abusive systems to defend themselves when they are accused of something. So it isn't necessarily like someone sets out to do this intentionally in order. It's just that this is the nature of abusive systems or abusers that they will try to do this. So the first is D for deny. So someone says, you know, that someone is lusting after you. Well, no, they're not. You know, no, they're not. Then it's attack. So say that the other person, so attack them, so get mad at them. Well, what were you expecting wearing that? You know, like if you show too much skin, he's going to lust after you. And then it's reverse victim and offender. So because you wore that, he couldn't help but lust. And so this is actually your fault that he lost control like that. So that's what it is. Deny, attack, reverse victim and offender.
What do you find is the major thing that disarms that? Because that seems like a great way to protect institutions and maybe even individuals, people who are in positions of power. There's a natural protection of male leaders. Yeah. And just that's natural to most evangelical churches. What is the thing that disarms the whole DARVO defense?
I don't know if you can in any way other than education. So let people know the facts about abuse, about modesty, about lust. Just get that message out there. And then remember that girls matter. Mm. Girls matter. And if I talk about the modesty teachings, for instance, which are so common in youth group, I remember my daughters, when they would sing on praise team as teenagers, they were told by one of the elders' wives that they couldn't wear skirts up on the platform because the men in the front row might look up their skirt. The only issue was the only men who ever sat in the front row were the elders when they were serving communion. So imagine giving that message to the girls. And these modesty messages are so widespread. And we found that they were so incredibly harmful. When you believe things like boys are visual in a way that girls will never understand, or boys can't help but lust if she is dressed like she's trying to incite it, her chance of experiencing sexual dysfunction, vaginismus, a sexual pain disorder when she's an adult, increases by 52%. Mm. Her chance of marrying an abuser increases by 68%. You know, her chance of having low self-esteem long-term, which results in lower mental health and worse job outcomes, worse relationships, is 30%. This is really serious. It's one of the worst messages that we measured. And yet it's everywhere, telling girls that men and boys can't help it if you are dressed a certain way. And so your body is a problem. And when we get that, when we make people realize that girls matter, like this stuff has long-term consequences. I hope people will start to listen, but inevitably when I talk about this, people say, but we need to remember how hard it is for boys. And I guess what I'm asking people is just to care about girls too, like care about girls, because girls do not deserve a 68% higher chance of marrying an abuser when boys could just simply be taught to respect women.
And I would imagine too, I know enough research to be dangerous. I know that there is the challenge of causation and correlation. Is this just two things that are connected, or is this one of the cause the other? But I would imagine there is a connection between the stats you just talked about, especially with abusers, but also how this teaching, this culture incites that into boys. Abuse is easier if you feel like a person's not a person.
Yeah, exactly. And we were actually able to tease out causation quite well in this one because we were looking at a longitudinal thing. Yeah. So we know that the modesty messages preceded those other things. So that's one way that it's easier to tease out causation. But yes, when you do teach boys that you are helpless in the face of girls, and so your sin is actually on them, It does breed a lot of entitlement. To give you one of the worst examples that we found, there's a curriculum called Secret Keeper Girl. It was also an event that was all across North America, for moms of preteen girls, so 8 to 12 year olds. And when we looked at it, it taught girls as young as 8, if you raise your hands during worship and your belly shows, then you're not being modest because bellies are intoxicating to men. And then there was a discussion that these girls were supposed to have with their mothers, where their mothers explained what intoxicating meant, how it's similar to being drunk or being out of control. And so your belly is intoxicating to the men around you, but God made you to only be intoxicating for your husband. And so you need to make sure these things are covered up so that men don't get intoxicated by you. So we told 8-year-old girls that adult men can get out of control if they see their stomachs. And this thing, I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of girls have gone to their events. They advertise it quite a bit, but this is not a minor thing. And this was really typical during purity culture.
As I was reading, She Deserves Better, which I love the title and I love that language of deserves. It is reminding us that the respect, and each of the chapters has a deserve in the title, that it's a right of being a human being created in the image of God. These are not just things that you're talking about as like a, it's not to dispel this, and I know this isn't, and this is not what I think, and this is not what probably anybody who reads your stuff would think, but this is not just some sort of feminist agenda. This is about the right a human has who is female, who has this right as created in the image of God. But as I listen to some of the things that have been said about sexuality and published, as you said, in best-selling books, and as I hear you say them out loud, I wonder for you, as you all were doing this work and writing this and saying these things out loud, writing them out loud, how did people who advocated for it not hear that and go, "Oh, that's terrible"? Like, what was the wall? As I'm reading them, I thought, as these things come out, how do we not see this and go, "Are you kidding? That this was a serious, like, that an 8-year-old would be able to have the prefrontal cortex to go, oh, well, my belly is dangerous," and just embed that story and not think, there's no space to think critically about that. What was the response when you started bringing some of these things out into the light, where here's our most read texts about sexuality, and this is what they're saying?
Yeah, so we've had interesting responses. First of all, the grassroots has been amazing. We have 1,000 people in our launch group for She Deserves Better. Great Sex Rescue has sold really well, and every day I get a multitude of emails, like not just one, many, from women saying, "This is so validating. I finally feel seen. I know that God loves me. I don't, it's not that Jesus ever said this," because so many women especially feel like God was their rapist, because it
Wow.
was God saying, "You can't say no, even if he's using porn, even if he's abusive, you're not allowed to say no, because then you're depriving him." And so just feeling like I actually have value and God's not angry at me was huge for so many women. So that's great. And many counselors are finding the book. And I've done a lot of Zoom calls with counseling groups. I've been to Christian universities, which is wonderful. The bad thing is that the higher ups have largely ignored it, including the authors that we call out. So we've had 4 lawsuit threats. Focus on the Family has scrubbed their website of any reference to me. American Association of Christian Counselors has refused to have us, even though we've done the biggest research projects in evangelicalism, and we want to talk about marital rape, and they didn't think that was important enough. So the big groups have not embraced us and are quite angry at us, but the people are noticing. And that's what gives me hope, is I think the change is not going to come because the people at the top change. It's going to come because the people at the margins, which is where Jesus was. Jesus was always at the margins. And they're the ones who are going to know, no, we need, you can't take my Jesus from me. And this teaching is not of Jesus. And you can't take that from me. I want my Jesus back. And I think people increasingly are saying that.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I grew up in the True Love Waits kind of culture. And what I've noticed, and I had scattered stories about it, but you've done such a great job of putting together the big picture of what happens when a student, a teenager raised in what purity culture, and we'll talk about that. A student raised in purity culture then gets married, carrying all those expectations about what married sex is going to be like, and then how the realities play out. Can you talk a little bit about what happens when we go from purity culture as teenagers to the expectations of married sex from an evangelical perspective? That's a huge question. I'm sorry to that's a fire hose question, but I'd love to see you paint that, because you all in your research do such a good job of painting that picture of what that looks like.
And so largely what we did was we told teens two things to make them not have sex. First, we threatened them. If you have sex, you'll get pregnant, you'll die, you'll get STDs, you'll be rendered infertile, you'll have soul ties, you'll never be able to bond with the person that you marry. So we told them all these threats, and then we bribed them. And we said, but if you wait, you're going to have the most amazing sex ever, and your sex life will be blessed, and it will be awesome. What we didn't tell them was very much sex ed. And I forget the numbers because I'm not the numbers person, Joanna is, but there's a high proportion of women who didn't even know that female orgasm existed until after the age of 20, some even after the age of 30. So women are getting married without often any idea that what pleasure is, or that they can feel pleasure, or that they should feel pleasure. We're getting married believing that intercourse alone is what is supposed to do it, whereas it doesn't for most women. And boys have been fed this bribe too. You get married and sex is going to be awesome. And so they're very much expecting it, feel very entitled to it. And when things go wrong, because 22.6% of evangelical women experience sexual pain, vaginismus, which is over 2 to 2.5 times the rate of the general population. Wow. And much of it can be traced back to the way that we talk about sex. That's what we found in our studies. And so sex can just be one of these huge disappointments, because we largely sold a sexual prosperity gospel. If you do everything right, your sex life is going to be amazing. But we didn't give them any tools to figure out how to get them there. And for many people, it was a huge disappointment. They did feel ripped off. They felt very deceived, especially when sexual pain was part of their story. And then you can also get into issues of coercion, because so many guys especially were told, you have a right to sex. Now that you're married, she should be giving it to you all the time. And when she doesn't like it because she feels no pleasure, then they feel like they're being deprived.
It's letting that, I think that should be a meditation for people, to just let that sit with the causes and effects of what happens. And what I do like is that you have a conversation in She Deserves Better about the difference between the scare tactics or the bribery that you just talked about and teaching teens to have actual sexual ethics. Like, a strong sexual ethic is something we all need to have. And I think talking about it as a line, you mentioned that in the book. Let's talk about this as a line you draw. This is where we would go up to, but no further. And having that strong sexual ethic is important. But just the bait and switch nature of the way we teach sexuality and how we don't teach pleasure to women and girls, or just even how everything functions, and not having any idea. And most of what's heard, so social media last 6 months or so has been kind of alive with this, with articles that have come out that have been just ridiculous and have been redacted and pulled down, and books about sexuality that equate our relationship with Jesus to, you know, just insane not, I don't want to call the person insane, but again, when you say these things out loud, especially to someone who is not in the in crowd, if you brought just someone, meet somebody on the street who isn't a person of faith and said, here's what churches have been saying about sex. My guess is they go, well, no wonder there's so many problems. They may not have a better articulation, exactly. But they know that, well, it's not, I don't know what the alternative is, but I know it's not that. But that is as much individual teachers as it is a culture. And so I wonder, as you have done this work and done the writing and the research, obviously it all starts to point up, even as you've mentioned about the higher ups shutting down some of the things that you're doing. As much as this is training girls and boys and parents, it's also about a culture that reinforces this, that thrives on it, maybe even financially depends on it. How do we, in your view, how do we begin to, as individuals in a part of that culture, how do we begin to unravel the power of that kind of narrative about sex?
Yeah, so let me give you our biggest finding from the book, because I think this one's foundational. Church attendance and believing in Jesus are good. They're very, very good. They lead to better sexual satisfaction, better marital satisfaction, better self-esteem. They're wonderful. And our survey found this, but so have so many studies in psychology that they don't even measure it anymore. It is just a given. Okay, religiosity is a good thing. It is such a given, they don't look at it. They'll look at it on sub, like they'll look at more sub issues or try to tease out, you know, tiny things, but that is a given in psychology. So church attendance is great. But as soon as girls start to believe these really toxic things about modesty, about how they're responsible for boys not lusting, you know, about even some of the really harmful ways we talk about sex, all of the benefits of religiosity disappear, to the point that girls would be better not going to church at all than going to church and being taught these toxic things. That's a scary reality, but it's one that we need to deal with. So church attendance is good, but the toxic stuff is so bad that it takes away all of those benefits. But if I can take you back in time to fourth grade when you were studying averages in math class, you know that if something is overall good, but there's something pulling down the average, then there has to be something pulling it up. So if toxic stuff is pulling down the average, then but the average is good, then there has to be stuff that's really good. And I think what I want to encourage people to do is look for the good. We don't need to prop up systems or churches that are spreading toxic stuff. And that means we've got to get involved. We've got to know what our youth group is teaching and what our kids are hearing. And we need to speak up. But we also aren't responsible for changing those churches. I know, because I tried. We stayed in two different churches that were so toxic. We switched sort of when my one daughter was just starting high school. We switched churches. And then we tried there for many years too, and put in every effort we could. And we just couldn't make that church budge. But then we landed in a healthy place where they don't teach this stuff. And so I just want to encourage people that you don't need to stay in the toxic places, because if those of us who didn't believe the toxic stuff, if we all banded together, we would be larger than the churches that do. And there are healthy places out there. And so I really want people to know that it's not like you have to walk away from church. Not all churches are the same. And religiosity is good. Believing in Jesus is good. Following Jesus is good. It's just that a lot of this toxic stuff is still there, and we're allowed to say no to it.
There's a practicality to the book, She Deserves Better, specifically for mothers and daughters to have conversations. I wonder if, I'm sure across the board, people who are listening to the podcast are in various stages of life, but anything that's good, as a person who teaches a lot in the area of spiritual formation, anything that's good is something that has to be practiced, that has to be disciplined into us. Are there some practices for people who are maybe rehabbing their view of God and sex or their own sexuality, whether they're married or single? Are there some things that you would invite them to do that could help to unravel some of those narratives?
I think we need to get a better view of what intimacy is. And this is true for our marriages, but it's also true for what we want to teach our teenagers. I think we focus so much on ideas of what we are supposed to do, but we miss the why. We miss what is it that God is trying to do in our lives. And God wants wholeness. He wants community. He wants real connection. And it's that real connection that can actually keep our kids healthy and safe. You know, when we teach our kids that you don't need to pretend. If you think your youth pastor is totally off the wall, now you need to be polite. You need to, you know, treat them with respect, but you're allowed to disagree. You know, you are allowed to have your own thoughts and feelings. And you're allowed to talk to me about your thoughts and feelings. And even if I disagree, I am going to hold space for that, because I am not going to require you to pretend to be something you're not. That is the only way intimacy is possible, is when we don't require people to be something that they're not, but we accept them and we allow them to come to us with vulnerability, with everything that they are, and still say, I want to be in relationship with you. That's what protects our kids, is teaching them, hey, you're allowed to think for yourself. It's also what protects our marriages. When we say, our aim is true intimacy. It isn't just that we go through the motions, that we make sure that we are having sex every 72 hours, even if it's no good for her, even if she feels used, even if she is making a grocery list in her head. No, we realize, hold on a second, there's something far deeper here that matters. And let's get to the deeper thing. Let's not just check everything off the checklist and miss out on really knowing each other. And so if we can get back to this idea that God wants us to be completely vulnerable with him, which means we can tell him when we're restless. We can tell him when we're upset. We can tell him when we're joyful. We can tell him when we disagree, because he can handle our questions. Then maybe we'll be able to start doing that in our relationships as well. And that is what's going to stop the toxicity from spreading. When we say, you're allowed to disagree, you're allowed to have your own thoughts.
Yeah, some time ago, my wife and I, we've always talked about, in maybe articulating it, maybe not like this, but this is the way I would articulate it now, about sex being a privilege and not a right, and just being able to say, this is something that we get to enjoy together, but it's not mandatory, because at that point it becomes like what you're talking about, like grocery lists in your head. And then it allows us to know, to, I think the benefit has just been the self-knowledge, the way we know each other too. We can sense each other's, what kind of day we're having. We can sense, you know, a nonverbal cues about, yeah, it's been a rough day. So, you know, we can rain check for later, just because it isn't that mandatory. If you're not doing this, you're not fulfilling, quote unquote, whatever obligation that there is. And that's been really helpful from an intimacy standpoint, because as you said, it's allowing us to be who we are. And to say this, you know, this is something that is not, it's not something I ever have enjoyed, you know, a particular practice or habit or, you know, those conversations can be hard in the first year of marriage, but if you have them, I feel like they deepen that intimacy. I know you better at a much deeper level, if you're honest with me about that.
Yeah, and that was a huge part of the Great Sex Rescue, was just getting rid of this obligation idea. I think there's a fear that if we get rid of obligation, she's never going to have sex, because the only thing that's keeping her having sex is this feeling like she has to. And it's actually the opposite. If you want to awaken libido, then we need to get rid of obligation. And we looked at that with a lot of data, and it's like frequency is not the problem. Frequency is a sign there's something else wrong. And when your marriage is going right, the frequency takes care of itself. So let's work on that intimacy. Let's get rid of obligation, and you'll find that libido does awaken.
So, in talking about this topic, I mean, it's water that not everybody wants to wade into, and I'm so glad that you did. You and your co-authors have told the truth, and have done the research, and have articulated some things that are they're trimming away at a bunch of different cultural systems from the complementarian. Which, if people are listening, don't know what that means, meaning that women are built to be just helpers and men are always meant to be in roles of authority. And the power that that has had in churches for years, but also the way that that power has been abused. I wonder for you personally, as you've been doing this research, how has this changed you? How has this impacted you and your own way of seeing God and the church and yourself?
It's been really hard, because of the pushback we've gotten, and because people that seem to know the Bible so well, and that say that they love God so much, are still supporting messages that we know hurt, and they don't seem to care. And because of that, for the last few years, I just haven't been able to read a lot of the Bible except the Gospels. I'm just stuck in the Gospels because I need to see Jesus. And I find that very healing, because I can hold on to Jesus. And I hope one day that I'll be able to get back. I can do the Psalms too, because I think most of the Psalms David's yelling, and so that's what I feel like a lot of the time. But so I hope to get out of that, and get into the rest of Scripture again. But I think coming back to the Gospels, coming back to just who Jesus is, when we can get our focus on Him, it's very hard to keep spreading messages that are so harmful and quite selfish in many ways. And we can get back to caring as he did.
Yeah. That would be a beautiful thing to finally reunite the way of Jesus with the way of our bodies and the way of our sexuality. So I'm grateful that you are doing this work and pointing people back to that and unraveling some cultures and some narratives that are due to be unraveled. So thank you for doing that. Sheila Ray Gregoire is the author of 11 books, including The Great Sex Rescue. She's the host of the Bare Marriage podcast and the founder of To Love, Honor, and Vacuum. She's an award-winning writer, and she calls the church to more than just pat answers by conducting original research to find out what advice works and what really doesn't. Sheila and her husband Keith have been married for over 30 years. Together, they have two adult daughters, one son in heaven, two sons-in-law, and two adorable grandchildren. And Sheila apparently knits, even when she's in line at the grocery store. I didn't know that. Her new book coming out, She Deserves Better, is out now, and you can find that wherever you buy books. There is a link in the show notes where you can find that book. I would encourage you, I've read it, I would encourage you to take a look at that, especially if you are the parent of a teenager and you want to raise them well in the areas of faith and sexuality. My new book, The Gift of Restlessness, A Spirituality for Unsettled Seasons, is available now. You can pick that up anywhere that you buy your books. That also is in the show notes. And as you go from this episode, may you think critically about the stories you believe around sex and your body. May these not be awkward topics that you avoid, but places where God calls you, where the divine calls you to think about your body incarnated in this world and how you interact with others, specifically when it comes to sexual expression. Have a great, great day. Peace, friends.